Welcome to The Sound of the Hound, a podcast about the early days of recorded sound. My name's James Hall.
And I'm Dave Holly.
And in this series, we look at the technology, the characters, and the stories behind the invention of recorded music over 120 years ago.
We trace the pioneers.
The dreamers.
The adventurers.
Who risked life and limb in their quest to bring music to the masses.
And who embarked on extraordinary feats of derring do in their mission to capture sound.
These people ultimately changed the way that we listen and, incidentally, spawned a multi-billion pound industry in the process. Let's explain a bit about who we are. I'm James Hall. I'm a music journalist and author.
And I'm Dave Holly, and I'm a long-time music industry exec. I used to run Abbey Road Studios, and I'm now a trustee of the EMI Archive Trust. I wouldn't consider either as particularly gramophone geeks.
Or phonograph fanatics, no. But what we are is obsessed with this extraordinary period of time. Our episodes will feature a range of characters, but one character you'll hear about again and again is a man called Fred Geisberg, who was effectively employee number one in the UK recording industry and opened Britain's first recording studio in Covent Garden in 1898.
Yeah, he really was the maestro.
Yeah, he was the Steve Jobs of Victorian London.
The Simon Cowell with a handlebar moustache.
So why is this podcast called The Sound of the Hound? Because we're doing it with the help of the EMI Archive Trust, which is a vast music and technology archive based in Hayes.
The EMI Trust celebrates the history of recorded sound and the work of the famous EMI group of companies, which include the Foundation Company, the Gramophone Company, and also HMV, his master's voice.
Which is why we've named the podcast The Sound of the Hound after Nipper, the dog in the famous HMV logo.
This is The Sound of the Hound.
Hello, welcome to this week's episode of The Sound of the Hound. I'm Dave Holly.
I'm James Hall.
And this week is the second episode in our little set of stories about the Gramophone Company's recording expeditions to Russia at the turn of the 19th to 20th century. Last time we covered Sinclair Darby's first trip in 1899, and then Sinclair Darby and Fred Geisberg go back in 1900. They've been trying to get Chaliapin, the big Russian tenor, to sign and record for them and failed, but they came back with a load of great recordings. I think you've got some background as to what...
Just to what they did after that, before this second Russian trip that we're about to talk about. So Fred had gone to Italy in the first half of 1900, having come back from Russia on the expedition we've just heard about. And he went to Italy with a chap called Belford Royal to learn how to record onto wax master discs. Now, this is important because, as we heard in our previous episode, the master discs before this were made of zinc, which had to be dipped in acid, which had all sorts of dangers, the dripping through the roof, etc. Wax got rid of the need for acid and zinc. Yes, so basically the cutting stylus, as you recorded, cut directly onto the wax, and you could then make an imprint off that, a negative, and then make the positive, and then you basically make the record. So he learned how to use that. Also in late 1900, William Barry Owen, who was Fred's boss, effectively, made a rather strange decision. He reckoned gramophones were only a temporary phenomenon and weren't really taking off. So he announced that the company was going to diversify into typewriters and become the Gramophone and Typewriter Company.
So I guess that was new technology.
That very great, very new technology. And they were selling, you see, unlike gramophones. Typewriters were... Now, if I was Fred, I'd be a bit pissed off with this. You know, I've risked everything to travel around the world making recordings. But apparently he wasn't. Partly, I imagine, because he was a shareholder and he got his first dividend of £126.
Wow, which on the back of his 1,000 shares.
On the back of his 1,000 shares, exactly. Yeah. Now, thanks to the Bank of England inflation calculator website, that is worth £15,000in today's money. So what does Fred do? He has a party. in the Maiden Lane studio, he gets lots of people around. They have a good old party. And Belford Royal, who'd taken him to Europe to... Apparently, it was the highlight of the party. He was an old Navy guy, and he danced a hornpipe on a table, and basically they caroused the night away, and it was a wonderful event with this first divvy check. So that's where we are. And then in early 1901, our friend Rafov, the Russian agent, do you remember the one who was sent to Siberia?
He's the St. Petersburg guy, yes. Who'd been sent to Siberia
For seducing a girl pupil.
Yes.
Sent to Siberia. He turns up in London. This rather shady character, he just pitches up.
Which makes you think, what's going on?
Well, Fred says the following. He's a brilliant man, Rafov, and a true artist. It doesn't sound like either to me, but a devil for intrigue and foxiness. He put some bad notions in my head concerning breaking away from the gramophone company and forming something with him.
Ah, so that's interesting. So he's a bit of a sharp player, old Rafov. If you remember from the first episode, he was the one trading directly with Sinclair Darby and the Deutsche Grammophon Company illegally, because they had Deutsche Grammophon Company had no rights to sell material into Russia, and Rafov was the Grammophon Company's agent, so he was
dodgy,
dodgy, 100% dodgy. But I think at this point the Russian market is exploding probably more than any
it's
other.
It's taken
market.
Off, hasn't it? Yeah.
Maybe it's because the Tsar and the Tsar's people have favoured the technology.
Of course.
But whatever happening, the record music was very vibrant in Russia and the recording business was developing nicely. So Rafov's over here basically asking the gramophone company to come and do more recordings,
to go back. He's,
yeah, make more records so we can sell more records.
Exactly. Yeah. And William Barry Owen, the boss, he agrees.
Yeah.
And he agrees to fund a second trip to Russia. Partly, I suspect, because the size of the discs was going up from 7 to 10 inches,
yeah,
which gave them an extra minute of sound, which, yeah, apparently had all sorts of great consequences.
Well, I guess, you know, so many songs are 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes, whereas, yeah, when it was 2 minutes before,
and that extra
you'd get snippets of songs. And Russia, what's interesting is that they've got not only these agents in various cities who are, I guess, helping gramophones be sold. And also helping attract, or should be attracting, artists to record for the gramophone company.
Yeah.
But they've also actually set up a gramophone company office in Moscow. And they've sent, he's actually an American guy over, N.M. Rodkinson.
Rodkinson, yes.
He was a handsome man and ruthless in business and love. His two absorbing pursuits.
Business and love.
Blimey. but he seems to fit in well with Mr. Rafov and his ilk.
Rodkinson does.
Yes.
Yes.
They feud, apparently. Rafov and Rodkinson feud. I should imagine he's like the police, Rodkinson, and Rafov's the naughty boy who's getting up to all sorts. But Rodkinson wasn't so shy of also attracting money his way that probably wasn't due him.
Yeah.
So he's over representing the gramophone company. Apparently he had a terrible stutter.
He had a terrible stutter, poor man.
And actually, what's the difference between a stutter and a stammer?
That's interesting.
I actually looked it up yesterday. There is none. I always thought a stammer was maybe a slightly different speech
different
impediment.
Form.
But he had a stutter when he was under pressure. But it says that he was very keen on gifts.
Funny that.
And so it looks like there's a lot of money being made in the gramophone business from shops selling gramophones, etc., and records. And he was an important man in Russia. And the different dealers would compete to get, I guess, when new records came in, they'd get the first dibs on those records to get the best deals, to get discounts.
Rodkinson was the man out there, wasn't
so
he?
So Rodkinson's the man representing the business of the gramophone company. And apparently what he liked was presents. And it says here that he would begin by making it known when he had dealings with these dealers that his wife's birthday was thereabouts, or maybe his own birthday or wedding anniversary. And that, of course, credit to a certain dealer would be reduced unless he... And then he would develop a stutter and not actually explain what he wanted. But this is Fred remembering him in his memoirs. It says, the dealer in question, without waiting for him to finish, would rush out to a jeweller's and return with a diamond brooch or a gold watch with a card saying, many happy returns of the day. The tap of the credit would then be turned back on again. And so he would have his watch or his gold bracelet or whatever it was, and the guy would be able to buy records on credit
records
and make money.
And didn't he actually showed Fred, when Fred turned up at Rodkinson's house, he said, come and look at this. And he actually displayed all his wares in a room. This is like open bribery. Yeah, and they were an array of gifts was displayed in the salon, comprising silver samovars, cut glass vases, gold cigarette cases, baskets of hothouse fruit, and elaborate photograph frames.
And he said, Fred remembers him saying, look, Fred, he said at the response to my birthday, don't they love me? So he's complete shyster.
He is a shyster. Yeah. But you'd rather have him working for you than working for the opposition, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So you can imagine why Rafoff and he would fight. Rafoff's probably looking for bribes from the same people.
Well, exactly. So we're at the 25th of March. Fred's arrived in St. Petersburg again, I think en route to Moscow. And he says, a heavy snow was falling and the weather was very cold. So my hopes for a regular Russian winter were fulfilled. And together, on the 27th of March, they went to see Eugene Onegin by Tchaikovsky at the Conservatory of Music. And it was this time that a tenor, a guy called Sobinov, agreed to record for them. So they're out of the tracks.
Yeah, and he's getting towards the Chaliapin. It's not Chaliapin yet.
But we're getting towards
that level of artist.
And then that weekend, something interesting happens. So we're at the beginning of April. Fred's walking down the street, or sledding down the street. No, he's walking because he calls them sloppy, which I think means sludgy, i.e.
the snows are turning. Yeah.
With Mrs. Wilkinson, so wife of their agent out there, and the recipient of all these wonderful gifts. And they walk past a shop, and he sees Mrs. Rafov, so the wife of the other agent, in a record and gramophone shop full of plush red chairs and potted plants. So Fred walks into the shop and says hello to Mrs. Rafoff. And he discovers that the shop, guess who it belongs to?
Mr. Rafoff.
Her husband, Mr. Rafoff. So basically, Rafoff's trip to London to convince the gramophone company to record more in Russia, it was entirely self-serving. It was so that he could get more stock for his shop.
Yeah. And he's got one or two other things that he's working on. And one of the other things, Rafoff and Lebel, who used to fight in the way that...
Cats and dogs, yeah.
Rapoff and Rodkinson now fight.
Yeah.
They've now thinking of setting up a rival syndicate to the gramophone company, and Fred finds himself being invited to join it.
Yes, yeah, so he goes out, and if these people are meant to be allies,
yeah.
Him and Rafoff go out for a bottle of wine, over which Rafoff says, "Let's do a breakaway.
Leave gramophone. I guess Fred, you do all the recording. I'll do all the selling." We don't send any of the money back to England. We keep the money, make a fortune. He should have done it.
He should. But Fred, being Fred, he doesn't want to do the dirty,
well,
does he?
He's on a shareholder. Well, there you go. Gramophone company.
And he basically says, no way, Jose. Yeah. No way, Rafoff. And I think convinces him that greater success is just around the corner because they're about to have these breakthroughs. So Rafoff, he does a reverse ferret, as we call it in the media. He kind of backs down, doesn't he?
I didn't mean any of that.
Of course. It's just an idea.
Yes.
But then he goes on to suggest putting fake labels on the records to sell them at a higher price, doesn't he?
Well, this is interesting, I think, because what he does is he says, it's kind of market differentiation, isn't it?
Yeah.
He says, they're kind of black labels ordinarily, but he says, if you put red labels on for certain acts, we can sell those at a higher price. So they're saying this level of recording is worth X.
But would these proposed red labels be gramophone company labels?
Yes.
So he's not siphoning them off to make money.
And this actually happens. They start not just in Russia, but this idea is taken and run with across a premium label,
basically.
Yes, so the premium label's red. So when Chaliapin is signed, ultimately, he's not at the moment in our story, but he goes on to a red label, and various stars recorded in England and France and Italy, they go on to the red label, whereas the more ordinary fare and the comic fare and the folk songs, they stay on the black labels.
You suspect that Fred had a grudging respect for this, because he said in his diaries, didn't he, after this meeting, that Rafoff lifted us out of our small town mentality.
Yeah, I mean, Rafoff's saying, get Chaliapin. He's saying also, when you've got superstars, you raise your pricing. Rafoff is an entrepreneur. He wants to make money.
There's a sharp mind behind his.
Yeah.
But it's a reasonably successful trip, isn't it? Fred makes 254 recordings, which is a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot. And that April, he returns to London, where he starts dating a lady called Miss Dolly Weston.
Dolly Weston.
Who I initially thought was one of the Dolly sisters, who were instrumental in the whole Gordon Selfridges story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They used to kind of perform in the window, model in the windows and throw parties on the roof. It wasn't, because their surname was Dolly rather than the first name. So this was Miss Dolly Weston, and her and Fred, they go to Richmond Park. They go to this, the Star and Garter in Putney, you know, that restaurant by the river that's still
there.
They take riverboat rides. And by this point, someone else has arrived, haven't they?
Well, yeah. Back in America, pre-1898, Fred's brother Will wanted to get in on the recording industry. And clearly, the gramophone company need more recording people. Because they are, you know, Russia's banging on the door saying they need more recordings to sell. And I suspect most of the markets are saying the same. So Will comes over. He's been employed as a recordist. And, yeah, I mean, Fred goes out on these dates with Miss Weston. And some of them, he takes Will along.
Oh, that's very sweet. Isn't that lovely?
But there was jealousy in that relationship with Weston. There's a diary entry from the night before he's due to go to St. Petersburg for what would be his second trip. Dolly went to the Derby with a SA fellow. I'm guessing that's South African fellow. Yeah. She threatened not to go if I so desired it. Real good of her. Will and I, Ed Butman, who's one of their friends, and Miss Scott, another lady, all dined together at Gatti's. I caught my train at 8:25. So
they left on a sour note.
They left on a sour note, and she's going to go off to the Derby with a South African chap.
How dare she? I suspect we may hear more from Dolly. Who knows?
We may, yes.
So June 1901, Fred once again goes to St. Petersburg, and he's got kind of Russia fatigue because he describes the journey as awfully uninteresting because he's done it so many times.
And he's on his own on this trip. So previously he went with Sinclair Derby.
Yeah,
and
so he's on his own.
Yeah.
But Raffov, there to meet him, tells them that they're doing £2,000 worth of gramophone business a month, which in today's money is £250,000.
Which is not bad for
a
startup.
It's not bad at all. So,
and that's just St. Petersburg.
That's St. Petersburg, yeah.
Rapoff's business.
So that's a hell of a turnover, really.
Yeah.
They make a few recordings in St. Petersburg, then head south to Moscow. And it's on the train to Moscow that Fred sees something that... It's quite a sad event, really, that will stay with him forever.
It's weird, isn't it? Yeah.
It's quite chilling.
Yeah.
Do you want to show...
Well, his memory is, there was this guy that basically the conductor was checking tickets.
And somebody
who Fred describes as a distinguished gentleman can't find his ticket. And the conductor goes away and checks other people's and comes back. And Fred's watching this. He said, it's really interesting because... I don't know if you know anything about the industrialization of Russia, but the Tsar kind of dictated where all the train lines went, and he wasn't interested in dilly-dallying on the way between St. Petersburg and Moscow. So he basically drew a line on the map and said, put the railway line there, and it just went through miles and miles of boring countryside.
No towns at all.
Which is probably why Fred was bored on the trip, but also why he was watching this guy. And then the guy comes back, the conductor, and questions where this man's ticket is.
And he's a distinguished gentleman, this guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's well-dressed. Yeah. This time, Fred writes, my fellow traveller, protesting frantically that he had a ticket but could not find it, was deposited in the open fields as the train stopped. So they basically, the guy didn't have a ticket, they stopped the train, kicked this man out, and left him.
And then, in Moscow, a few days later, Lebel, the agent, showed me a newspaper account of a body being discovered near the railway track. On inquiries being made, this was found to be this chap, who was travelling on a government pass, which was discovered in the ticket pocket of his waistcoat, just where a ticket should be carried.
So the guy had died.
I mean, he had a ticket all alone. He was turfed off and then just, what?
But you think, you know, if you're hundreds of miles from the nearest place,
you
basically killed the guy.
It's extraordinary,
absolutely
isn't it?
Astonishing.
Ugh.
They should have a revolution and change the country. Oh, they did.
Anyway, they arrive in Moscow, and recording is a huge success. In less than a week, Fred gets 67 records.
Yeah, and this is Lebel now is the guy that they're he's hanging out with,
and Rodkinson's there, so they're agent in Russia, and Lebel, yeah,
and they're chaps as well. I mean, there's a fantastic they do a lot of recording, but they again, old Fred is partying hard, and there's.
When they dine in this sort of garden.
He meets up for a night out with Lebel, Rodkinson, so that's the Russian agent who's come from St. Petersburg. Gross, I don't know who the Gross guy is, and he, so there's four of them. He could see they were out for a bummel, B-U-M-M-E-L, all married men. It impresses me as criminally shocking the lax manner in which most men observe their marriage vows.
Criminally shocking.
So they have supper together, and then at midnight they go and have dinner. So they've had supper, and then they go and have dinner in a in a sort of strange place he calls a cabinet. And they instruct the head waiter to send us in four artists to sing for us. They happen to be a quartet of Austrian dancers and singers, very swell girls and lively. They spoke German and one spoke English. This is the line. This is from Fred's memoirs. Well, for 3 hours we raised old Ned. You could bathe in the champagne. When we left, the sun was shining bright, but still the garden was in full swing. That's the garden where they're enjoying the nightlife.
That's a good night, isn't it?
So he's all flirting with girls.
He's all flirting, but then the next day, something terrible happens.
Ying to his yang, I think.
He gets a letter from Dolly Weston in London.
A nasty letter, he says.
It's basically dumping him, isn't it?
Got dumped.
For not having enough money.
Yeah.
So her trip to the... It was the Derby, wasn't it?
With the South African.
With the South African. He obviously...
He's got a gold mine, I think.
So he gets this letter dumping him, which clearly... I mean, he was clearly quite into Dolly, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he was very upset. So... He makes an extraordinary decision. Most of us might just go out partying or go home to try and sort the situation out. What does Fred do to get over it? He decides to stay in Russia and go on a recording adventure inland to record Tatars
in Kazan.
Yes, so he goes into the Russian interior, which can only be described as pretty rough terrain. It's quite eccentric. It's baffling, really, to record Tatar music in an area 300 miles away. Now, Tatars, remember, they were sort of the tribes of the Mongolian nomads who were part of the Genghis Khan army hundreds of years before. Rough people.
Yeah.
And for some reason, he decides that Tatar music is the thing to capture.
What called him to that?
I mean, no idea. Maybe he wasn't thinking straight. I mean,
or maybe, you know, young men go off and join the Foreign Legion, don't they, in these days when their heart is broken. And maybe he was just looking for dangerous adventure.
But he goes via a town called Nizhny Novgorod.
Yeah.
Now, if you remember the Football World Cup last year, 2018, I'd never heard of Nizhny. The England team played a few games there. Do you remember?
It meant something to me, but I hadn't put it together with football.
So no. England went to play in Nizhny, which is how we know. Anyway, he got the train to Nizhny and then a boat.
Because Nizhny is on the Volga.
It's on the Volga.
Yeah.
Where they have these huge trade shows and traders from all around Asia come and sell their wares. I mean, it sounds like a really fascinating place.
Volga. I keep thinking one of the blooming Wombles was called Volga, but it wasn't, was he? Why would I know Volga?
Cars.
Popular culture. No, I'm having a brain.
Uncle Bulgaria is my go to Womble.
Yeah, Madame Cholet. Yeah, I know. No Volga.
But there's a wonderful description.
Tomsk was one. I think I'm getting Volga and Tomsk mixed up. Sorry.
Wonderful description of the boat from Nizhny to Kazan, which I'm going to read because it's rather lovely. At 12 o'clock on the morning of the journey, we boarded our ship, which looks more like a three-story houseboat with paddle wheels. It was interesting, if for no other reason, that we had fish dinner on the open deck of the steamer, during which the ragged, half-naked stevedores sang while loading sacks of meal and cement. I shall forever remember the rhythmical swing as the green watermelons were passed from deck to barge. On every hand one heard music. The haulers moved in rhythm to their song. The loafers on the docks or the passengers on the decks below, with a small concertina, organ mouth or balalaika, joined in groups. So they basically, it was this rather lovely kind of slow-paced, very rustic journey across Russia.
But with lots of music.
Lots of lovely music.
You must be thinking, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
Turns out not to be.
So he sits on the deck. Kazan. And he's just... Yeah, so he's sitting on the boat. And they reach Kazan eventually on the 25th of June, which is a city that's partly Russian and partly Tatar.
Yeah.
And Fred's... I think it's safe to say Fred's not... He's not overly impressed, was he?
Well, it's funny because he sort of seems to really enjoy travelling and then seems to really react badly to new people.
he describes this as like, the Russian part of Kazan... especially contains handsome buildings and churches. The streets are orderly and there are plenty of parks. But the Tatar section is beyond doubt the dirtiest, filthiest, vilest smelling place I have ever come across.
I mean, he comes back again and again to descriptions of how much these people smelled.
Yes.
Houses smelled.
They have a peculiar oriental smell about them that seems to asphyxiate you. I always feel faint when I'm near them.
He's not very woke, is he?
He's not really on PC now. Yeah. Can we read this bit? Should we read this bit?
I'll read it out. But, you know, this is Fred remembering back in the 40s what it was like at the beginning of the 20th century.
They're quite oriental in appearance. Small eyes, expressionless, immobile features. The women of the better class are never seen. Strict seclusion is enforced. And should they go out, it is always closely veiled. Now, this is a terrible thing to say. The custom is laudable if the women are as ugly as the commoner class we see.
Now, so basically they smell and they're ugly.
It's horrible. So what on earth possessed him to try and record this quite obscure ethnic group whose music may or may not, how he heard about that, I don't know. But also people that he clearly has real disdain for.
Yeah.
Very strange, isn't it?
I was looking at how big the
Tartar.
It takes me back to that joke with, who was the famous newspaper, Kelvin McKenzie of The Sun. He always said what would be the ultimate headline that he would like to have written. And he said it was on the, if Archbishop Desmond Tutu had died. And he wanted to write Tartar Tutu. And that would have been his ultimate headline. It's not spelt the same. It's T-A-T-A-R, the Tartar people.
T-A-R.
How big is the Tartar market? There's about 5 million of them.
Oh, really?
Now there are. So let's halve it. There's still 2.5 to 3 million people there at that time.
But from what he's saying, they're sort of...
How many gramophones do they have? Not many.
Well, particularly if they are as poor as he suggests. I mean, gramophones were a luxury, weren't they?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a very curious decision.
Actually, there's an even more politically incorrect...
Is this when he's trying to record them?
Yeah, so he the first people he tries to record, he actually pays them 5 rubles to stop.
To shut up.
And bring somebody who could sing. And then he brings... Do you want to describe the two people?
Well, so he finds this local man called Malakoff to find singers who basically just, as far as I can tell, just kind of gathers together the first Tartars he can find. And they set up a studio in the Hotel de France, where he's rigged up his outfit. Malakoff brings in some Tartar artists. The first he brought in was a petrified, yellow-skinned accordion player with a musty smell to him. Very likely he did his best, but the music haunts me still.
It was so terrible.
So he paid him to stop. And then, and forgive me, this is terribly un-PC and not very nice. Then Malakoff brings in 2 vile-smelling creatures with little squeezed-up eyes and broad, fat faces. Their love for hair made them tack on their heads a variety of greasy, mildewed strands of false hair until it reached to their knees.
So they had hair extensions.
So fake dreadlocks hanging to their knees. Their singing would bring tears to your eyes. The song would be a rhythm of about 8 bars repeated over and over again to the accompaniment of a fifth in the bass, brackets accordion, organ point fashion. We asked the accordion player if this was the best he could do, and he said it was. He said that Tartars have no artists or places of amusement and that he had to recruit these people from disreputable resorts.
Why did he do this?
His heart was broken. Look, poor Dolly had dumped him.
Yeah.
Dolly had dumped him, been partying till 3 in champagne he could bathe with. He was horny and alone. He thought, right, sod it.
Let's go.
There is one more description, which I think sums up. I think during this session, Fred realises... Game over. As he'd done before, he decides to find his own singers. Despite the terrible day he'd had, he goes out talent scouting on his own again. And he heads to a Tartar wine bar, wine house as he calls it. And he sets up his equipment, I assume in this shack. And it's here where he loses, quote, the little respect I ever had for them. It doesn't sound like he had much anyway. Filth and smell, no name. They, the Tartars, would crowd about 8 men and 8 women in this unventilated box of a room. In the centre, there was a table with a kerosene lamp. The harmonica would start up, and one of the merry monotone dirges would begin. Then the crowd would join in and continue for half an hour with the most solemn expressions on their stony faces. Well, we saw all we could and got out as quick as possible.
Yeah, he didn't have a good time.
He didn't have a good time.
He said ta-ta, ta-ta.
That's very good.
Not quite Kelvin McKenzie. And he heads back to St. Petersburg. And then And there finds telegrams telling him to get himself back to London.
Get back to London.
There's things we need you to do.
There's more other things to do. But he does sum it up pretty well, doesn't he? This is
from his memoirs. I'd put in 6 months, beginning a zero winter of deep snow, fur coats and troikas, and finishing in a blazing summer of buzzing bees and flies. I'd seen opera performances on a scale unbelievably lavish. Only the wealthiest family in the world, the Romanovs, could support them. I'd heard and negotiated with a bevy of the greatest and perhaps the most spoiled artists of that epoch. Added to this were my first impressions of Russian music, ballet and decorative art, then at the height of their freshness and vigour. Another and totally strange world of music and people was opened up to me. I was like a drug addict now, ever longing hungrily for newer and stranger fields of travel. Already I began to lay plans for a trip to the Far East.
I love that description. I'm like a drug addict now.
Yeah.
So despite his disappointment in Kazan, he, you know, you get the impression this was a real sort of eye-opening, kind of quite fulfilling trip for him, isn't it?
But I think that's true with travel. I mean, I did a bit of backpacking and hitchhiking when I was younger, and I remember getting back from the first one and just vowing never to do it again. I hated it. I was tired. I was cold. A bit like going to Tartar. And then as soon as I'd had a shower and put some clean clothes on, I was planning my next trip.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
Because you remember the adventures at that point and the exciting of new things.
But I mean, and although the trip, the final trip didn't work, and he got back to St. Petersburg where all these telegrams were saying, come home, you suspect it lit a fire in him, as he said, didn't it? And the trip to the Far East,
Well, that's what happens next.
That's what happens next.
The one thing that we've kind of been teasing you with is, or Fred's been teased with, is Chaliapan, this great tenor that they're trying to tempt into recording. They fail in the first three trips that Geisberg's on. So Geisberg's back in June 1901. The gramophone company does finally get Chaliapan, and in fact Fred becomes his great friend for decades afterwards. But Fred doesn't get to record him. It's Mr. Darby. Sinclair Darby gets him.
So Sinclair was in Russia before him and recorded Chaliapan.
Yeah, so Sinclair Darby's an interesting card isn't he?
They're all slightly... double dealing slightly.
Double dealing. Cads and... they're adventurers.
He's Indiana Jones. This is the Indiana Jones episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
But more to follow.
So Darby heads out there and he's sent by the gramophone company in December. Again, Raffoff requests more recordings. Fred's off doing other things, which we'll get to. And Sinclair Darby goes over there and records Chaliapan at last. But interestingly, and Dr. Kelly, who's the great authority on this period, he actually says that Sinclair Darby records him. But Howard Friedman, who's an all equal authority or a concurrent authority, if not equal, says that actually if you look at the matrix numbers, the number that each recording was given, each of the recording engineers in the early days was given a prefix letter. Mm. And the prefix letter suggests that it wasn't actually Sinclair Darby, but it was a guy called Arthur Clarke.
Oh,
Arthur, not Arthur Sixpence, Arthur Clarke. And interestingly, we're recording this in Balham in London, and Arthur Clarke lived two streets away in Bolingbroke Grove.
There you go.
So that's our connection to
this. That's our connection, as we said. And a little coda to this story is Fred got back from Russia. What did he do? He did what all of us do after we've worked hard. He asked for a pay rise.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Guy's been exhausted.
He's knackered.
Yeah. But actually, he says in his diaries, and I can't remember exactly what he says, but he thanks Dolly Weston. Because Dolly Weston
has propelled
him to earn more money so he can be more attractive to the ladies. And so he goes in and he asks for a pay rise. I think he goes up to £12 a week.
It's not bad, is it?
Which is not bad at all.
This is the sound of the hound.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Sound of the Hound. If you'd like to see the show notes, which contain links to some of the things we've been talking about in this episode, please go to thesoundofthehound.com. Select podcasts when you're there, and you'll find a page of notes for this episode. Sound of the Hound is a podcast from the EMI Archive Trust. Many of the recordings and artifacts we talk about in this series of podcasts are housed by the Trust. If you'd like to know more about the EMI Archive Trust, go to emiarchivetrust.org. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please take the time to leave us a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. That would be much appreciated. Thank you.